Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul. Thank you for listening. In the spotlight, this episode is Barb Howard. She is a Canadian novelist, and her latest work is a novel called Happy Sands. It's actually a novella, weighing in at just about 140 pages. It's about a boozy, judgmental massage therapist on a working vacation. And Happy Sands was recognized by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation as one of the 23 funny books for your holiday shopping list. And the CBC also listed it as a book to watch in the fall for 2021. Barb Howard has been publishing short stories, essays, and books since 1993. She's a former lawyer who has been president of the Writers Guild of Alberta, a writer in residence for the Calgary Public Library, editor of Freefall magazine. She's taught creative writing at the University of Calgary, Mount Royal University, the Alexandra Writer Center, the Banff Center, and at various grade schools and conferences. And she's going to teach us a little bit about writing during this episode. Barb Howard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And I have to say, I'm a real sucker for comedic novels. And when I saw Happy Sands and I read the first paragraph, which I'm going to share with our listeners, that captured me. So listeners, it goes like this. This is just the first paragraph of the novel and of the novella, I should say. And it goes like this. Call me Ginny. My real name is Jeanette, but to me, that sounds like a too small bottle of booze, the kind you used to get on the airplanes. I'm a massage therapist. My forearms are tanks, not tankettes. If I use the right technique, I don't have to apply much pressure, but even light pressure, day after day, body after body, makes for a hearty forearm. I'm rounding the corner to 20 years in this profession. I'm good at it, and I've made a lot of people feel better. I even do massages during my annual summer vacations at Happy Sands. For the money, but also because I like helping people. Well, most people. That's the end of the opening paragraph. And, you know, Barb, when I read that, it's lively, it's bouncy, and it just sets everything up in a way that says, I want to learn more about this woman. I want to learn more about who she doesn't want to help. Where did the inspiration for the novella come from?
Oh, well, you know, I'll start by saying it's just a treat to hear someone else read your work. It's just, you know, I haven't heard anyone else read it yet. Different things are emphasized just because we read differently. And I thought that was terrific. Thank you. Inspiration for this novel was a couple of things. I had read an anthology of short stories, summer stories, I think it was called, edited by Lisa Moore in Canada. And I thought, I should write some summer stories. That's really a nice read. And so it began as a short story, and it began me thinking, you know, a lot of Albertans drive to the interior of BC, the Okanagan, for their summer holiday. So that was sort of a setting, and me and my family went to a place with some cabins, and I thought have always thought this would be a great setting for a confined setting for a story. So those couple of things, but I'm always interested in the concept of vacations too. You know, are they fun? Are they fun at the time? Are they more fun in retrospect? And the main character here, she has a bit of that retrospect issue. Like everything that from the summer before was better.
You know, I always find that the best vacations are really good in retrospect. In fact, they sometimes grow to be better. The first river cruise I took in Europe was one where after the fact, as the weeks went by, I realized I really want to go on another one of those. It was really one that kind of, it was one of those creeper vacations that got better as time elapsed. My wife and I ended up going on another one. What about you? What makes for a good vacation? Or does it have to be good in the moment? Or in this case, you've got your lead character, Ginny, who there's some hijinks on the vacation. I mean, things don't exactly go as intended on the vacation. Is there, what can you say about your approach to this that isn't giving anything away to the would-be reader?
Well, I can say things never go entirely as planned on a vacation in my experience. So I don't think it's giving away, say maybe a takeaway from the book would be being in the present maybe makes for a happier one rather than thinking of the previous. event. In this one, some of the things that go on are some pranks, set of three pranks, and Ginny is a suspected prankster. And then there's also the appearance of the buff beach guy, Dwayne Champion, who having fun with these things. This book started as a very dark story of a holiday, and I worked it into from a novel. I worked it into a short story, and it was in a collection, and I thought good enough. But I always felt like I never got what I was going for. It wasn't in the pandemic. It was before the pandemic. I thought, why don't I just write something fun? You know, why do I have to? It's not making it better to make it put these dark layers in for this particular book. So then I thought, why don't I just go all in and put in that buff beach guy and put in the sporty family and the motorboats and too much drinking. I think Ginny drinks too much in this book, but a couple of people who've read it have said, no, that's just vacation drinking.
Yeah, vacation drinking. There you go.
Which was kind of a surprise to me, but there's a lot of plastic furniture. And I just thought I'd just play with that whole scene.
So a massage therapist, people always say, write what you know. I dispute that to some degree. I say, write what you want to know. So you do the research and you learn about it. But did you have any experience with massage therapy, whether you used to be one, you've been a recipient, or you have a friend who's a massage therapist? How did you, or actually you might feel that not that much knowledge is required to render the character. I don't know.
Well, I agree with you on write what you know. You know, write what you want to know or what you can learn. And massage therapy was one thing I was really interested in. I mean, I have had massages and perhaps used this writing of this to justify more massages. But it's a very interesting job. And for a character, it's great. The character gets to legally, with consent, touch the other characters in ways that I don't know who else would be able to do that.
That's a good point.
I did ask a lot of massage therapists for info, and I had to read various drafts of the book. And they have some amazing, amazing stories that could not go in here. They didn't fit in the story, or they were just, gosh, I can't put that in these
too
pages.
Racy or too, yeah, too
yeah, off color. Yeah. So I don't know if you have a massage therapist, ask for their story. My goodness.
So, you know, you've written, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different books. You've got Happy Sands, your latest one. You've got Western Taxidermy, which is a short story collection. Notes for Monday, which is another novella. The Dewpoint Show is a YA novel, and listeners, those are all listed in the program notes below. And also Whipstock is another one. But Happy Sands, correct me if I'm wrong, is your first book in 12 years. The other ones came pretty close together, but there's been this 12-year interval. What was the holdup, if there was a holdup at all? I mean, why did it take 12 years to turn this one out? Did you reach a point in your career where you're thinking, maybe I'm not going to write anymore? Or did you just get busy teaching and working with literary groups or what have you?
Yeah. I'm always thinking I'm not going to write anymore.
That's why is that?
That's been monthly since, what was the year you said, 1993?
That's when you got started. Yep.
Yeah. Probably every month since then. And certainly after every book comes out, I'm not doing it. I always say I'm not doing it anymore. So there are a couple of things on this. I decided to return to short stories. That's my first love. And even though the book before this one was my first short story collection, it was the best of, say, 20 years. And I just thought that book was going to do a lot better than it did. It was a bit of But, you know, the books seem to have about, unless they win a pile of awards or something, they seem to have a lifespan of about a year and a half or 2 years of really being active and doing things with them. And yeah, that was a bit of a downer, but I kept writing. And this particular book, like I was saying, I broke it down and it ended up as a short story in that collection, quite different than what it is now. And I just never felt it was done. I felt that there was this opportunity I was missing. And I think what the opportunity was to lighten the story up.
So talk to me about why after each book you think, well, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. Is it just such a big commitment? Is it so onerous that you just feel like it takes too much mind share, too much time and mind share, and you want to give it up? I don't think that's an original thought, by the way. I don't think any of us have not thought about just stopping because for some of the reasons that I outlined there. But what was your thinking on this, or what hits you when you're done with a novel? I'm sure it's like giving birth.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if people have, well, yeah, I guess I do. I do know people who say it's fun to write or that sort of thing. I don't know. I find it really, really hard. And say, if you have a book like this, it's not like I was working on it for 12 years. I was rejigging and then I'd work on another project and then I'd come back to it and see why isn't that working? But yeah, all that work. And then, you know, a lot of people love the launch process. But for me, the finished product is never as good as I imagined. I think that's just the nature of writing. It never exactly meets the vision. And so that's a little bit of a letdown after a project too. And also, you know, they say, or I've heard that, you know, your book is done when you know the fatal flaw, or you know the flaw that you can't fix in it. Otherwise you would fix it. But you know that there's something not quite right in it. So yeah, when they come out and you think all that work and still I didn't get it right.
Yeah, I think there is that sense, I think, in every writer that I know I'm capable of better. I know I'm capable, not even necessarily that particular project, but just the feeling that I know there's a voice inside of me that is more exhilarating, that is more literary, and I'm not sure how to tap it. I want it to develop. I want it to come out, and I see hints of it, but I want it to be the kind of voice or the kind of experience that's much more abiding than it is. So I get it. So let me ask you about the short story collection, Western Taxidermy, which I have not read, but I'm curious to know whether those stories are, is there anything, any common thread to those stories, or is it the kind of thing, are you jumping around to different subjects? And I ask this question because I think one of the struggles or one of the deficits with short stories is that a person can get a novel and they know its subject matter that they're interested in. With the short story collection, the subject matter tends to change from story to story unless somebody decides all of my stories are going to be focused on a particular subject matter or some kind of particular vein. What was the case with Western Taxidermy? Were you doing a whole variety of different stories, or was there any common thread?
There's a variety of different stories over a long period of time. And I think short story collections are hard to sell to publishers to begin with. And the collections without a theme or that aren't linked, I think, are the hardest. That's my understanding. So I agree. And I think that people... lots of people say they don't like short stories, and sometimes I think maybe they would sit and like read in bed and try and read three at once or something, whereas I would read a short story collection. I love short stories. I'd read one, and then maybe a week later I'd read a different one from a collection. So I would read it differently than a novel. I would probably wouldn't read front to back, but that's just a reading style. I'm working on a collection now, and it is probably going to be themed, and
is
in a way that's easier.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be themed, and in some ways it feels more contrived. And I see people marketing their themed or linked story collections, like if you have repeating characters in them or one character that flows through or something, I see people now marketing those as novels. I recently reviewed one of those for a local magazine, and I thought, this is a collection of short stories. And in order to get into, well, a publisher or the awards categories and all those sorts of things, it's being pushed into the novel slot. It was a great book, still a great book, but a publisher driving the form a bit.
So the short story collection you're working on now is, how far along are you? Or don't you know? Sometimes we don't know how far along we are.
Well, short stories are pretty good because you know how many you got. And I don't write very big books. So I have an idea. I would say, I'd say I'm halfway. You know, I have about five stories. I'm a really slow writer. I would write take me a year to write a short story. I'm doing other things at the same time, or I set it aside and work on it. But yeah, I'm not a person who can run one out each month.
So you're a lawyer who became a writer. Are you still lawyering? Do you still have your license? Are you still practicing law, or have you left that behind?
I left it behind.
I
left it behind by writing a piece about it. In the matter of my law career or something, I think I have it on my website. I kept trying to hang on to it. I thought I got the education, and I kept trying to work it into. I wanted to do a book at one point on law and literature. It's an area of interest of mine. Maybe it'll still happen. But in terms of practicing, just when, you know, after you haven't done it for a while, I don't think you should do it unless you rewrite your exams. So I backed off. My love would have always been writing. I would have taken law in order to earn a living. And it's worked out well. And I think it plays into writing a lot. I can understand how they're linked. I've never taught writing, like I mentioned in the beginning, and almost always when I was teaching, especially if it was like continuing education style of class, almost always there would be a lawyer in my class. So I think there's a lot of lawyers who are writers or who are attracted to law for the writing side of it, more than, say, litigation or the adversarial nature or those sorts of things.
Yeah, you know, being a journalist, I've worked with a lot of lawyers, interviewed them for stories and whatnot. And they, as a group, they like to write. I mean, you do a lot of writing as a lawyer, but it's stilted writing. It's legalese and all that. And there's definitely an interest there, more so than almost any other profession I know, that lawyers just think in terms of, it would really be nice to write, to be maybe even a journalist. They don't like the pay cut, though, so they end up not doing that.
They know that each word matters. So if I'm teaching a short story class I guess in some ways people would be thinking, no, they don't, look at all the extra, you know, look at those dumb documents and on contracts and stuff. But they really do get how choosing one word or the other, may or shall, or those sorts of things make a difference. And so that saves a lot of steps. And also, I think becoming writers just is a lot of practice writing, doesn't matter what. So lawyers usually have that, usually from law school or from the, I don't know how it works in the States, but in Canada, usually everybody has a degree before law school.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that every word, a lawyer puts a tremendous amount of emphasis on each word because they're legally loaded. I mean, there's certain terms that need to be put in a document, and there's legal risk if it's not handled properly. And that's very much like what we do. I mean, when you write, you want to make sure that every word is carefully chosen and that it delivers the best payload and that it's the most accurate and so on. So here's this move you make to fiction writing, and you also teach. So
and it was more like I'm kind of embarrassed to say it wasn't like an assertive move. It was like a drift. You know, I was in a law firm, and then I was in the contracts part of a gas company, and then I was working for a legal publisher, writing the case notes and things from the cases that come out of the courts, and then I was doing that at home. So it just slowly happening. Maybe that's why I like assertive characters in my stories. It was definitely not assertive. It just kind of happened. And then it was like, why would I get insurance for this career? Or why would I remain a member of the bar?
When you do teach, what do you emphasize when you're teaching fiction writing? I mean, what are some of the chief elements that you want to convey to students about writing?
I don't so much now. I don't teach. Every once in a while I will, but I'm mentoring a number of immigrant women writing stories right now. And I guess the main thing to them that I'm trying to convey is it takes a lot of drafts. What's that story about the guy who ends his letter saying, if I didn't have enough time to write a shorter letter.
Right, so right. I think it's attributed to Mark Twain, although
yeah.
I'm not sure if it was really him, because people get things attributed to them, like Yogi Berra being an example of every saying seems to, well, we don't know who it is, so let's say Yogi Berra. But yes, it takes time to synthesize, to reduce the length, rather. Less time means you're probably going to just put out more volume.
Constant drafts and constant, yes. and deep drafts, not window dressing drafts. That's what I'm doing right now. I think.
What's a deep draft?
Well, say often when you look at a short story or a novel, I'd say you look at a short story to edit it, you think, what happens if I take off the first paragraph? Nothing. What happens if I take the second paragraph off? Nothing. And you do the same at the end. Like often there's a bunch of filler, right, bookending the whole thing. And a novel, maybe, do you need the first chapter? Usually we don't in the first draft. You know, usually they take too long to end, unless you write like me and end too quick. So, but it would be, you go in and you say, what happens if I take out this character? You know, what happens if I take out this whole scene? Or, what would happen if another person came in, like really getting in there with a mixing spoon and seeing how could I make it better, or what's the story trying to tell me it wants to be about? That's what I'd say a deep draft is. But in terms of teaching, I've changed a lot over the years what I think is important. So I'm saying drafts now. I think years ago I would have talked about plot or a story arc, traditional story arc. And I'm not sure that that's helpful so much anymore. I'm a fan of the workshop. I'm a fan of workshopping, but only in, certain ways.
Why don't you think it's as helpful to talk about story arc and plot?
Well, I think some stories work despite those rules. So maybe it's a matter of knowing the rules and you're not using and that you're not using them.
I think
in that time, so now, like in world literature, does every culture use those same story rules? And, or have they, we sometimes been imposing, what am I saying? Is the short story arc product of like colonialism or something like that? I don't know that I want to even go there for the conversation, but just I think I'd be more open to different forms. Like I had a student who was really into opera. He wrote short stories in an operatic style, which is kind of deadly in current short story workshops. Everybody say no, they wouldn't do that. That's over the top. That's but why not? Why not have these characters who are like dying, fainting opera singers, at the peak of the show? Why not try that? So I'm more open to that now. I can't say it always works, and I'm just trying to open my own mind a bit more.
Yeah, the thing is that you don't get any kind of avant-garde type writing if everybody's kind of pushed down that path of you need a plot. and you need a story arc, or you need the character, your protagonist, to evolve, and so on and so forth. And you need an ending. Obviously, you don't need an ending. Movies end without endings at times. Novels certainly do that. Some of my favorite novels are not heavily plotted, and a lot of times they don't have any definitive ending. It's much more open-ended, which I prefer because it gives you something to think about and talk about with other people who have either read the book or have seen the movie with you or what have you. So
yeah, I agree. But I do think, I mean, I have, I don't know if it's a rule, but that's one thing I haven't really been able to rid myself of is I think something has to happen. Like, otherwise it's a description, and that's a valid form of writing, but not a story. Like, I feel like something has to happen somewhere in a short story or in a novel. So I do stick to that one a bit.
Yeah, but you don't have to have a heavily plotted novel for things to happen. It can be much more character driven. It can be more banked on vignettes than it is a strong storyline. So, I mean, they used to say about John Updike that he writes beautifully about nothing. And I remember one critic said he's the greatest novelist who's never written a great novel. He's a great novelist who's never written a truly great novel, which I dispute that just because I think Villages was a great novel, but the critics didn't really recognize it as such. So,
well, the critics are tricky. They do control a lot.
They do. And that's, I think, another reason why, you know, a person needs to really kind of follow their instincts and their heart when it comes to writing, because so often, well, an example, A Confederacy of Dunces, which was really a novel that wasn't about anything. It had a character who was very funny and colorful, but who is the famous editor who retired? He wrote a book about his career as well. It's escaping me right now, but he had worked with John Kennedy. John Kennedy O'Toole, was that? It was John Kennedy Toole, yeah. I think was the guy's name, the author's name. And he worked with him for, I don't know, months, I think years, trying to put that thing into shape. And ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize. Now, it was not without some controversy, because people felt like it was awarded posthumously because he had committed suicide. And there were some people who felt that there were other things at play there rather than strictly the quality of the book. Anyway, my point being that
there always is. I think.
Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. And my point being,
how can there not be? Yeah.
That's a book there where there's all kinds of critics and editors who would have said this thing isn't publishable, or it doesn't say anything. And yet it's so many people have read it and really enjoyed the book. So now when you talk about deep drafts, so, you know, here's students who you're saying you're going to write a lot of content. You're going to write a lot, and then you're going to turn around and have to be willing to throw a lot of that out. And that's tough for some people because they put the effort in, and at the time they liked it. And you can have stuff that's actually good writing that is just not providing continuity. And you have to just make the decision that, you know, maybe it'll have a place in something different in the future, but it's not going to survive the editing process of this novel. I'm going to throw it out.
For people like me who don't, you know, I always find, not to make a dichotomy, but there's people who write short and people who write long. And for the people like me who write short, I mean, you know, we are just barely eking out the words. It's kind of devastating, you know. It can mean half goodbye, half your work. But man, you know, they think of all it took to get those words out. But in my experience, for the people who write long, often when I work as an editor, it's almost like relief. It's almost like the words came out and they couldn't lasso them in, and if you can somehow help them lasso those words into something tighter. Mostly who I've dealt with, feel grateful, seem grateful. Mm-hmm. Like it was like a spew, or they just, you know, people write thousands and thousands of words a day, but can't, you know, and you say, don't turn on your internal editor and all of that. So they don't. So then, yeah. But there are people, sometimes I say, always keep your long draft. Always keep that. You can always go back and pull things from it that you have. And then, but keep your short draft going too, like the one that meets the word count for whatever you're submitting for or whatever you're trying to do.
Yeah. And I think that gives them some comfort, the idea that I'm not throwing it out entirely. I'm just, you know, I'm editing it out, but I still have that original draft and the long form draft. And I can always go back and retrieve something if I really decide that I can't kill that baby. I'm gonna
it's like another, that's a kind of a riff on well, the line, you know, murder your darlings when you're writing, yeah. You know, your favorite line's kill probably gotta go.
Yeah.
But it's more like, you know, I like to phrase it as, it's not right for this piece. You can keep a darling file, maybe you use them later.
Exactly. Now, when you are writing, which you are now, what is your process? How do you write? What's kind of the mechanics of your writing process?
As in the actual story, I'm linear. That's kind of an uncreative thing to say, I guess. So I usually try and start at the beginning and then I try and fumble through. And so, say for a novel, that might make for a 10-page novel that I start with. And then I try and expand, rewrite it, and inflate it slowly. It's not efficient. And then if I'm going through in my fourth draft and trying to get it up to 50 pages or something, then I I'm stuck. I know there's an area that needs work, and then I hop over that and carry on to the end again. It's not like that's the beginning and the end when the work is done, but I do like a sense, and I maybe I'll rearrange things at some point. But I, for me, that's I like to see the road that I'm heading down, or even if it's the wrong one.
Right. You want to keep things in order, and you want some sense of destination. You know where you're heading with this thing. Do you know how it's going to end before you start?
I always think I do, and I'm usually wrong. So that's one of the joys of writing for me is the turn that you take when you're making your connections or sorting out what's going on and then realize what you thought isn't what possibly could happen in the story that you've just written. I know I often say to students, after you write something, always ask yourself, what's it about? Because it's often not about what you thought it was. And then that's usually means your conclusion needs a twist to what you had previously or something different maybe, or maybe you know, entirely different writing.
So if you're structured in that way where you like to start at the beginning and forge ahead to the end, does that also mean that you're regimented in your daily writing practice? Do you get up a certain time? Do you work at a certain place? Do you put in X amount of time? What is the actual process like for you?
Yeah, terrible. You'd think if you had one, you'd have the other. I try new systems all the time for being regimented. I've never found one that works. I've written in cars, written in coffee shops. I don't write sometimes for a couple of weeks if I'm on something, doing another project, or you know, getting back to Happy Sands. Maybe if I was on vacation or something like that, I wouldn't try and write there. And sometimes my most common go-to is I try and touch the piece of writing every day. So. Or touch a piece of writing every day. So that might mean sending out a short story or something, or it might mean if I'm working on a bigger thing, going in and writing a paragraph or opening it and writing a line that I thought of could be that small. That could be why it took me 12 years for this last book. And for editing, it's different if I have a deadline. not entirely different. I get the thing done. It's just not in a practical way that I could show a calendar schedule to. But for editing, Happy Sounds had a deadline on that. And I ended up using the Pomodoro technique. And I would use that again. I don't know that it's good for early drafts, but boy, when you got to get something done.
What is that technique? I'm not familiar with it. Pomodoro technique?
Pomodoro, I think it was an Italian guy that started it, and he had a timer on his desk that was in the shape of a tomato. I think that's why it's called Pomodoro. And so it's 25 minutes, take a 5 minute break, 25 minutes, take a 5 minute break. And every 25 minutes is called a Pomodoro. And that is super regimented. So this is the price I pay for my lack of regimentation. I end up having to do something like that or go into some sort of, 3-day lockdown with water and sandwiches to finish a project.
Then there's people who focus on word count rather than time. Instead of saying I'm going to do the Pomodoro technique and I'm going to run through that 5 times a day, or I'm going to put in, 6 hours a day, they have a word count that they, minimum of X number of words I'm going to produce. Because you could actually put time in and sit there and stare at the screen and think really hard about that next sentence or the right word and so on without producing a lot of copy. So what about that? How does that work for you?
I don't do it. I don't worry about it. I do know, I guess I've been writing long enough about, say, for a short story. I have a sense of how many words one of my short stories is. It's about 3,500 for the style that I write in, or generally what I do. So on those, I keep an idea. And I know how many words overall books should be. I write novellas, so obviously I'm not getting there all the time. But that wouldn't work for me, I don't think, especially because sometimes I don't get very much done on the page. But the Pomodoro, that Pomodoro wouldn't work for me every day after day. That is, boy, Barb, you got yourself in some trouble. you got to get the thing done. That's when I pulled that out. And I would use it again. But you're right. You could sit there for 25 minutes. I think the theory is just like, just the same along with my, touch the work, do something every day with the work. The idea is you get in there and you get mucking around with your writing and then, oh, look, an hour's passed. That idea.
Yeah. Time can pass. Yeah. Especially when things are going okay or well, time can pass very quickly. So is there a novelist who influenced you most, or a short story writer who was a special influence in your life or your writing life?
Well, in Canada, we have Alice Munro, who's our Nobel Prize winning short story writer. I think she's influenced lots of short story writers. So she would be for that. Then I have writers that I like for different things. I'm a big fan of Roddy Doyle. I like the whole style here. It's like the Commitments and Paddy Clark, ha ha ha, Irish writer. Mm-hmm. His amazing dialogue. If I'm teaching dialogue, I'm bringing in examples from Roddy Doyle. And he writes funny but poignant books, funny but sad. He might be one of my biggest inspirations on what I'd like to write.
So talk about dialogue a little bit, because I'm sure when you're working with students, you talk about dialogue, you teach some theories to dialogue. What do you consider to be, what do you try to achieve with your dialogue?
Well, I try and achieve a sense of reality and that nobody stumbles over. And then I'm a believer in if anybody's saying anything, there needs to be a reason for it. Like, how does it develop your story? So maybe not people answering the phone and saying hello, you don't need that part. It doesn't add to the story. You'd put that part maybe in exposition and then have what happened in the phone conversation. And then for students, for some people just get dialogue. They get it. And then for others, sometimes it's more of a learning process of saying, of realizing that realistic dialogue in fiction or believable isn't actually what people say in real life. It's a curated version of that. I think that's important to know. So if somebody says or things that I'm probably saying in this podcast too much, you don't put that in all the time. You might put it in once so the reader has a sense of it. Or you might, in a way more curt or shorter, I would say.
Yeah, when people say, write like people really talk, I think that's deadly.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it really is, because I'll tell you a little story. This happened years ago. I was just a kid, and this is back, the old landlines, and I guess I don't even know really what a party line is, but they used to talk about party lines. But I remember one day I picked up the phone and I heard these two young women talking, and I knew they were young just from their voices. And when I say young, teenage years, and I was, my God, I don't know, maybe 10 years old. And I said, hello, can you hear me? And they couldn't hear me. And they were just talking away, having a conversation. So my curiosity got the best of me, and I continued to listen, thinking, well, this will be interesting listening to these two young women talk. And I was not on the phone for very long before I hung up, because it was so vacuous. It was so boring. But that's how people talk. And if you write dialogue like that, I just don't think that's a winner. I think it needs to be, you indicated, something that's maybe a little more clipped. Or I like dialogue that's kind of otherworldly, where you have interesting characters and they're saying things that is maybe unusual or really defines their character a little bit, rather than sounding necessarily like, as an example, my favorite novel ever is White Noise by Don DeLillo. Uh-huh. And he won the 1985 National Book Award. Well, you read the dialogue in there, and it's not real life dialogue at all, but it's fantastic. It's very illuminating, and it's very funny, without it being punchlines. Not punchline funny. That's not real humor to me, is when people are trying to deliver a punchline. It's a kind of humor where even if somebody doesn't have a sense of humor and they don't see it as comedic or funny, it still works.
You don't want the real time version.
No. Yeah, you want I'll just throw this in there too, that I remember on 60 Minutes, they had a story about these boys who were kept in they're all brothers, and they were kept in an apartment by their father. They never saw the outside world, really. They were indoors all the time, but all they did was watch movies and TV. And finally, they got sprung free. I don't know what happened, if the father ended up dropping dead and they had to leave, or what happened. But they were asked by the interviewer on 60 Minutes, so what was the biggest surprise to you coming out into the real world? And they said, how slow things move. Because when you're watching television, a television program or a movie, everything happens. There's so much that happens in the course of minutes or a half hour or a couple of hours. And in the real world, it's not like that at all. Everything moves very slowly, which I find interesting. And when you think about writing, I think you can think in those terms as well, of how, we know how maybe things evolved over the course of these couple of years, but we're going to distill this. We're going to distill this. We're going to get into the act of reductionism and make things happen. As you were saying earlier, something's got to happen. Well, you can't take too long making things happen, or a reader just can lose interest.
Yeah, it's sort of what to focus on, or what does Ursula Le Guin say? Crowding and leaping. when to focus, when to go high speed. It's tricky. In dialogue, I'm I'm a fan of He Said, She Said, and I'm with, say, Stephen King and other people who say, stop with the adverbs afterwards, like he said sadly or she said happily. Take those out.
Are you a believer in that or not?
Oh, I'm a believer in taking them out. Yeah.
Yeah.
But not everyone is. And I definitely have been edited where someone's saying, you know, can you say how? And I'm like, oh, I don't think I want to say how. I think what they're saying should show how. So I wouldn't have to say it, or the context of the story or the conversation that's going on. That all should be clear.
Yeah. If you have to say sadly or said enthusiastically,
yeah,
then the words you've chosen that they have spoken are not communicating to the reader, or you don't trust that they've communicated to the reader. That's the other part.
It's like, oh, yeah.
It's
trust
you
is
have
huge.
Read. Yeah. Isn't it? Because
I think, yeah,
that's how trust. A lot of overwriting occurs, is that I don't trust that the reader is getting this. So I'm going to give more verbiage to this thing.
You talked about the funny books to read, and it's just such a funny or humor, or it's so tricky, and it is all a trust game. But everybody has, especially when it comes to, say, humor, different sense of humor. So it's a tough one to trust on.
It is. That's, I think, one of the stumbling blocks for writing. And one of the reasons I heard George Saunders talking about this, you talk about a short story writer. There's one of the great acclaimed short story writers of our time.
Yeah, I love
and
him.
He was saying that, what ends up happening is there is that lack of trust, and you say it, but then you add another sentence. It's basically saying it another way. And what you're really doing is just a fancy dance, is what he called it, a fancy dance. And, you know, it's kind of like doing a little bit of showing off with some wordplay when you're really just adding extra verbiage that doesn't belong there and is really there because you didn't trust one of two things. You either didn't trust the reader, that the reader got it, so you're not trusting your own writing. And maybe you shouldn't. Maybe, I mean, that's why you give it to people to read, or you give it to an editor so that they can say, I got it. Yeah, I get it. And, but on the other hand, also, if you're trying to be literary at all, it's very easy to fall into this idea that I want to show my stuff. I want to put a little razzle dazzle in there. I want to be slapdash and I want to be flamboyant. And so now I'm going to start putting in phrases and sentences that are really superfluous, but I'm trying to show off my wordplay. Well, the reader usually doesn't care about that. I do, but most readers don't.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, making the humorous thing and then running for the punchline, that actually makes it weaker in terms of craft, but makes it weaker in terms of if the thing that you had said first was funny, then it's not anymore. Yeah, I find that I in my early drafts, I err on the side of trusting too much on the readers. So when my editor's comment, it's usually what more here. So that it's not everybody erring on the too much. Some of us err on the making things too cryptic.
That can happen. Yeah, that's certainly the flip side of the equation. Now, let me ask you about the Writers Guild of Alberta. You were president there. What did the Writers Guild of Alberta do? What kind of role did it play? What kind of services did it offer?
So it's actually the biggest provincial guild in Canada, and it isn't big by other standards, but I think it's over 1,000 people now. It does the usual, like we have a writers union in Canada as well. Services like looking out for writers' rights, but also runs the local literary awards, runs programs, runs a conference, that sort of thing. For me, being president was a give back year, and comes back to having been a lawyer too. I end up sometimes in that kind of role because maybe I've been in that kind of role before, or I have legal knowledge about maybe filing or running an annual general meeting, how to run an election at an AGM or that sort of thing. But it was super valuable. I don't rely on the Writers Guild as much now, but definitely on my first book or two, that's who gets the word out. That's where the support groups were. That's who has the Christmas party or whatever, or the seasonal gathering. So you meet some people who can say, oh, I'm trying to write a book and it's hard. So I'm with you. Good on you for getting one done. Yeah. I think I hope everybody listening has some sort of writer support, even if it's just a small group of four people or something like that.
But the thing is that a lot of writers are, they're reclusive to some degree. They can be introverted. I think you and I had talked about the stereotype of the writer is a person who isn't inclined to communicate verbally a whole lot. So their channel of communication is the written word, and it would be easy to really just kind of keep to oneself rather than join a group and necessarily put the work out there for people to read and evaluate and be able to take that information and improve the writing. But obviously there's that particular Writers Guild, you said there was 1,000 members or so. So obviously there is an outreach that goes on there, but then there's the reclusive writers that I think do nothing more than write and then put it out there to an agent trying to find somebody who will support the work, take it out there to the editors and publishing houses. What do you think about?
They're the place where people would say, do I need an agent? Mm-hmm. Or what do you do after you? So a lot of the stuff, especially now, is online, and there would never be 1,000 people together, but just save some steps too. Like, how do you know where to send a short story? And someone could say, well, here's a bunch of resources or something. Maybe everybody can find that stuff anyhow. I don't know.
Well, Barb Howard, we're coming up on about an hour, and we want you to keep writing. I know that when you're done with your short story collection, you'll start having those thoughts again about, well, maybe I'm done. I'm done with this.
I hope it doesn't take 12 years.
Well, it sounds like you're well underway.
Maybe that's inspiring. Yeah, but I also read really slow. Yeah. Well, hopefully you keep podcasting and writing.
That's the idea. That's the idea. And we'll look forward to your short story collection after Happy Sands. But for our listeners, look in the notes field. I have all of Barb Howard's books listed there. And Happy Sands is the latest one. It's funny. And it's, again, a novella, only about 140 pages in length. Something that can be knocked off on a vacation, like the book is about. Read about vacations on your vacation. There you go.
Good
Barb
one.
Howard, yeah. Barb Howard, thank you for coming on the program. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mike. That was fun.